Imagine like waking up in the year 1410 and being told that the voice of God on earth isn't just one man. It's three.
Yeah, three different popes all at the same time.
Right. Three popes all claiming to be the rightful successor to St. Peter.
Yeah.
And they're all just, you know, excommunicating each other's followers. It wasn't just a religious crisis.
Oh, not at all. It was a total breakdown of this medieval idea of the seamless tunic.
Exactly. The idea that all of Europe was this one unified spiritual body. So today we're doing an exploration into the source material from the Reformation, Old Western Culture Reader.
Unpacking how that unified world fell apart way before Martin Luther ever picked up his hammer.
Right. We're tracing a line from absolute power to absolute chaos and finally to biting satire.
It's basically the ultimate be careful what you wish for story, because before the chaos you just described, there was this desperate attempt to centralize power. Like in 1302, Pope Boniface VIII issued this document called Unum Sanctum.
Oh, that's where he used the two swords theory, right?
Exactly. He claimed that God gave the church both spiritual and temporal power. He basically argued that while kings carry the material sword, they only do so at the, and this is a quote, will and sufferance of the priest.
Wow. I mean, that sounds incredibly top heavy. Like, if I'm a king, the Pope is basically telling me I'm just a middle manager who could be fired at any moment.
Yeah, pretty much.
He's claiming ownership of my throne, my laws, and, you know, my subjects' loyalty. How did they expect the secular rulers to just sit there and take that?
Well, they didn't. I mean, this overreach backfired spectacularly. It led to what historians call the Babylonian captivity, where the papacy was essentially kidnapped.
Right, kidnapped.
Yeah, moved to Avignon, France for 70 years. And when they finally tried to move back to Rome, the internal politics became so fractured, it caused the Great Schism.
Ah, right. The three-headed monster where three different men claimed the papacy at once. And that has to be the moment the magic of the office just breaks, right? I mean, if you're a regular person in England or Germany, and you see the papacy turned into a political football, you start looking for a different foundation.
Oh, absolutely. And that's where Marsilius of Padua comes in. He writes the Defensor Passus, and he basically flips the entire two swords doctrine on its head.
Right. He was the one who argued that the church shouldn't have any coercive power.
Yes. Meaning they shouldn't be able to force anyone to do anything through like law or punishment.
Yeah.
He claimed that legitimate power actually comes from the legislator.
And he defined that as the whole body of citizens, didn't he?
He did, which was completely revolutionary for the time.
But wait, I have to push back there a little bit. Marsilius sounds like a modern Democrat, but didn't he also say the state should be the one to punish heretics?
He did say that, yes.
So if the king is the one burning people at the stake instead of the pope, has the listener actually gained any freedom? Or did we just trade a religious tyrant for a secular one?
That's a really sharp critique. And honestly, it's the exact tension we see in the sources. Marsilius wasn't necessarily arguing for freedom of conscience in the modern sense.
He was arguing for order.
Right, order. He thought that if the church had its own separate legal system, you'd always have a state within a state. And that just leads to civil war.
So his solution was to make the church a department of the government.
Exactly. And this paved the way for the Council of Constance, where they decided that a general council of the church actually had more authority than a pope.
It was an attempt to use a committee to fix a monarchy.
That is a great way to put it.
But, you know, even after they settled the schism, the institutional rot didn't just disappear. By the time we get to the eve of the Reformation, the frustration isn't just coming from legal scholars.
No, it's coming from the satirists.
Right. You have Erasmus writing Julius Exclusus, which is, I mean, it's basically a 16th century diss track against Pope Julius II.
It really is. But it's more than just a joke. It's a total demolition of the papacy's moral authority.
Mm.
Erasmus depicts Julius II, who was this warrior pope who actually led armies in a literal suit of armor arriving at the gates of heaven.
Oh, and he tries to bully St. Peter into letting him in, right? Boasting about his wars and his wealth.
Yeah, exactly.
The detail that always sticks with me is Julius trying to use his key of power, like the literal key to his treasure chest and his political alliances, to pick the lock of heaven.
And Peter tells him that the gate only opens to the key of wisdom.
Right. The key of wisdom and a life of sacrifice. It really makes you realize that satire did something a dry theological debate never could. It made the institutional hierarchy look ridiculous.
Oh, for sure.
Because, I mean, how can you fear the material sword of a man who is being mocked in every coffee house in Europe?
You can't. It's stripped away the aura of the sacred. Once you start laughing at the armor under the robes, the psychological hold of the institution is just gone.
It's such a powerful reminder that the Reformation wasn't just this sudden explosion. It was a slow-motion collapse of a structure that had grown way too heavy for its own foundations.
Yeah, long time coming.
We often think of this history as a battle between the bad guys and the good guys. But consider the quote from C.S. Lewis in the preface of The Reader.
Oh, that's a brilliant preface.
It is. He points out that the real tragedy is that men like Thomas More and William Tyndale, who ended up on opposite sides of the executioner's block, weren't divided by their vices.
Right. They were divided by the depths of their faith.
Exactly. Which raises a really haunting question for us today. We usually think of conflict as something that happens when people are at their worst.
But what happens when the most virtuous, most committed people are the ones who can no longer stand to live in the same house?
Right. If faith and virtue themselves can tear the tunic apart, is a unified world even possible? Or is friction just the natural state of deeply held beliefs? Something to chew on,